This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. And coming up in the second half of the show, Sue Balcom joins us to discuss food trends in the new year. But first, the book Responsible Parties, Saving Democracy from Itself. It's a new book from Francis McCall Rosenbluth and Ian Shapiro. Both are political science professors at Yale, and they joined me by phone. Francis, thank you for joining me today.
Thanks for having us.
Ian, thank you for joining me today.
Pleasure to be with you.
So I'm going to overly simplify the book right now and say that you argue that recent trends to increase voter engagements are perhaps doing more harm than good, creating too many factions within the electorate. And then you advocate for a return to a stronger two-party system. I want to know how popular this point of view is. Francis, you can go first.
This idea that parties should be stronger strikes people as strange because in our era of polarization, it seems like parties are bad actors. And we're pointing out that the parties are bad actors because they have been split into so many different extreme groups by way of primaries. And if we get away from lots of different interest groups pulling parties in different directions, we can have parties that put forward big platforms that really aim at what interests and concerns most Americans.
So let's get into that bullet point of the argument. Why do you say what you just said?
Well, we see that, you know, primaries have been around for a long time, but what has changed and what has made primaries more harmful in the American political system is that there's been a lot of redistricting of districts to make them safe seats. So what that means is that the party that is in control of the state legislature creates districts that make it possible for their candidates to get elected relatively unopposed. And so that throws the election to primaries to determine who is going to run in the general election. And what that does is shift the emphasis away from the sort of median voter, the main group of moderate Americans in the political middle, towards those who have extreme interests and who will show up at primaries, which are low turnout events.
How low of turnout are we talking about, Ian?
Well, that's the dirty little secret about primaries that the American people generally don't know. Typically, primaries are about 10, 11, 12% of the electorate. In the case of Donald Trump, he was elected by less than 5% of the U.S. electorate. But what Francis is mainly talking about is Congress. And there, you, for example, Adriana Ocasio-Cortez, who's gotten so much attention in the media, was elected in New York in an 11% turnout primary in a very safe Democratic seat. Same thing happens on the Republican side with somebody like Jim Jordan of Ohio, Mark Meadows of North Carolina. And then what happens is that these people go to Washington. By the way, it also provokes low turnout in the general election because they're not really representative of the district, so people don't show up to vote in the general election. But in any event, they get to Washington, and either they compromise in order to do business, in which case the voters on the extremes of the parties who have elected them accuse them of having sold out and, you know, become turncoats and being career politicians, or they don't, in which everybody else gets furious about gridlock. And so either way, it's not surprising that voters are so angry and disaffected because all they see is dysfunction in Washington and politicians unable to serve their interests.
So can we just get rid of primaries?
Well, we think that's probably impossible because they're so deeply ingrained. But we do have proposals to blunt their bad effects, one being that what one we could do is say if there's less than 70% turnout in the primary of 75%, say, of the previous general election, then the result will be discounted and the congressional party would select the candidate. Because the congressional party leaders have an incentive to pick people who can both win in their district and support a national program. We really want parties to be able to operate as teams where everybody's pulling in the same direction.
If I could just add something there, another reform effort that would help quite a lot, which the Supreme Court may help with, is to redistrict these congressional districts so that they are more competitive between the parties. That would help push the parties away from electing these extreme candidates in primaries.
What do you mean by more competitive?
That means instead of these districts in which one party has a safe seat, and these are by design, you know, these state legislatures have designed and drawn lines so that their party's candidates are relatively unopposed. That is, they have locked in, by virtue of the way these lines are drawn, a majority of their party.
So this is gerrymandering.
Exactly. Gerrymandering to favor incumbents. And the Supreme Court could do us all a big favor by saying, this is really not what democratic accountability is about. This is not what elections are supposed to do. Elections are supposed to force parties to compete with one another so that voters really can choose between platforms that are designed to appeal to the broad American public and not the narrow interests that bother to turn out for these low turnout primaries.
When you say the narrow swaths of people, are you talking just, you know, the moneyed interest? Or, you know, when you say something like good for the broad mm-hmm. swath of people over the long run, there is a mm-hmm. group of people who has just been historically disenfranchised and mm-hmm. out of their choice, neither party really is reflective of what they want. And so that broad swath might never include them. So how do you include, I mean, part of why how we got to where we are today is trying to diversify voices represented.
Well, that is a good point and a real consideration. Majority-minority districts are one effort to make sure that people who have been cut out of politics have people who represent them. And this is called descriptive representation. The problem, though, is when you pack districts overwhelmingly with minorities, minority voters don't really have the parties competing for what they care about, what matters to them. And so if you look at the past few decades since minority-majority districts have been put in place, policies have not really shifted towards their interests. In a sense, they're even more an ignored group than before. So it's an example of an unintended consequence of something that may have been well-intentioned, but by making the parties, you know, feel free to ignore them, they really are relegated to a pocket of the electorate.
Just to add one thing to what Francis just said, if you think about the main advances for African Americans, the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965, those were enacted before the adoption of majority-minority districts. And since their adoption, there have been no major legislative advances for African Americans, which just underscores what she just said.
So what are your ideas for ways to keep up that diversity without losing a strong two-party system?
One idea we have is for each district to represent a whole range of people and interests. And should that be the case where every district is diverse, the representatives of that district have to care about everybody. And this has the good effect of forcing parties internally to care about everybody in the district. So does not leave votes on the table, because the parties would be competitively putting forward platforms that aim at everyone's best interests.
We're visiting with Francis McCall Rosenbluth and Ian Shapiro. They are both professors of political science at Yale and the authors of the new book, Responsible Parties, Saving Democracy from Itself. Ian, why does the book start in the 1960s?
Because this is the period where, it's not just in the U.S., by the way, but particularly in the U.S., when reforms started to be put in place to increase local control of politicians, parties, and political decisions, whether it's greater use of ballot initiatives, whether it's greater reliance on primaries, which we got in the Democratic Party after the 1968 Democratic Convention in Chicago, whether it is direct election of leaders. There are all of these devices that people have put in place to, they think, increase voter control of politicians. But what if the effect that it has had is essentially making it impossible for politicians to govern, because they are all on different leashes. You know, we say that the people should have more say, but the question is which people. And we, just as our discussion of primary voters indicated, these people who go to Congress are actually on the leashes of different groups and the people who are funding the different groups. And so they get to Washington and they are basically in straitjackets. Same thing is happening all over Europe. If you just look at the knots the German electoral system has tied itself into, her, it took 7 months to put together a government, and then the coalition that was formed between the Christian Democrats and the Social Democrats is both on very tight leashes from their grassroots supporters, who are also to the extremes of their parties. So they are losing regional elections and hemorrhaging support to other parties. And terrified of calling a new election, because the extreme alternative for Deutschland party, ultra-nationalist sort of neo-Nazi party, the polls show would do even better. So this is not just an American problem, but it shows up in different ways in different systems because of the basic rules. But the underlying problem is that there's a failure to recognize that parties are actually the lifeblood of democracy, because they're the ones that put together coherent platforms of policy. And if you compromise their ability to do that, they're going to appear to be dysfunctional and indeed will become dysfunctional. And that's the problem we're landed with right now.
So it's the argument of why doctors work really long shifts. They might be tired, but there's that continuity of care that doesn't happen if you're switching doctors all the time.
Well, that's one good way to think about it, that you want people who have the whole picture in mind. And, you know, to use your analogy of doctors, the doctors who have been taking care of patients need to be able to have some continuity of care. So just going back to what Ian said, why do we keep pounding at this idea of strong parties, and why are primaries undermining strong parties? Think about people who are representing, whether it's moneyed interests or well-mobilized groups of voters. They have very specific agendas, and they are going to require their representatives to remain accountable to them or throw them out in the next election, in the next primary. We want politicians who are accountable to a broad array of interests in their districts, who will then form common cause with the representatives from other districts to be a team, a party that comes up with a coherent platform that makes sense to voters. These are the platforms, these are the policies that we will put in place if we win a majority.
So what role do voters play? They've got to have some responsibility here.
That's right. The voters are the choosers. So the voters get to see what the platform is. They get to see a party put that in place and decide whether that works for them or not, which is why we like the idea of two strong parties, because if you have three or more, you don't really know which party is going to be in power and play what role. That really has to be worked out after the election in coalition negotiations. And so accountability is strongest when there are these two parties that have a very clear platform that the voters choose and watch in action and then decide whether they want that to continue or not in the next election.
You know, and you have made the argument, too, that this increasing splinter groups here and going off to the extreme, and yes, that will weaken the party, and that is your argument. But I'm kind of curious, you know, as Ian, you were talking about how this has happened a lot in Western Europe, and they don't even necessarily have the same system of governments that we have here. But I'm wondering, so look at France's most recent election. They had extremely fractionated right side and left side, where, you know, people were cannibalizing the Socialist Party and then Marine Le Pen with the Front National. And then what happened is the French electorate elected a centrist. So that is opposite of what you say can happen if we have too much on the left and right and not enough in the middle. Isn't it just as likely this could go the way that France did?
Well, so what happened in France, you know, it's a strange electoral system because it has single-member districts, so you would expect only to be two parties. But in fact, it gets lots of parties because they have two stages of elections, which keeps the small parties in. So it's a very fragmented electoral system. Hmm. And what happened is what you said, but it was a something of a chance event in the sense that, you know, there were corruption revelations at the last minute of the key alternatives to Le Pen that got Macron elected. But he created an instant and extremely weak party. All the French parties are very weak. And if you look at his popularity today, he's the least popular politician in Europe. You know, and what we aren't even a year into his presidency. He couldn't possibly get reelected if there were an election tomorrow. So the French political system is hopelessly fragmented. It has extremely weak parties, and they're at a state of semi-permanent war with the politicians they elect all the time. So, you know, people were delighted with Macron for, you know, in political time, about 10 minutes. And that's, you know, not a solution to anything.
Mm-hmm. How big of an impact do single-issue voters play on how elections turn out?
We think that single-issue voters are, in a sense, created by primaries, because primaries are the instrument that give these very narrow groups of voters an entree. If they were forced to form bigger coalitions in order to win a general election, they would have to back off from the one issue they really care about. And think about, I don't know if this would be very popular in your area, but, you know, gun control. Most Americans would like to have some level of gun control. If you were to leave it to the parties, they would come up with an idea about gun control that would be broadly popular. But because of primaries, it gives these groups like the NRA that don't want any gun control more leverage than they otherwise would have. Another example is, you know, referenda, a way to give single interest group voters a chance to pick off one popular issue at a time rather than to think about what the consequences of those would be for other things they also care about. So the, you know, Proposition 13 in California made it very hard for Californians to have the public school system that they also wanted because they were presented first with this opportunity to cut taxes. So voters do care about particular issues, but they care about a whole bunch of them. And peeling off issues one at a time puts the average voter at a disadvantage relative to those who are really mobilized around one issue at a time.
So build a castle in the sky here. Ian, I'll let you start. What's your perfect, and I use that word in quotes, political system?
Well, I would say there is no perfect political system. Everything involves trade-offs. But for us, accountable government is the most important value, and we would trade off the sorts of things Francis has just been referencing. We would trade off giving power to single-issue groups. We would trade off descriptive representation of minorities. And the way you get accountable government is for a party to run on a platform and win and enact it, and then if the results are good, they get reelected, and if the results are bad, they get kicked out. That's the most desirable. It's the sort of the British system before they started messing it up. They started messing theirs up also around the late 60s, early 70s with similar decentralizing reforms. So that's the model. And what we've got is diffusion of accountability. So when the president and the House and the Senate are all have different interests and they are all being held on different leashes by different groups and are unable to govern, the voter is left completely unable to determine who's actually responsible for what's happening and who to hold accountable. And that's what feeds the voter alienation and voter anger. And you won't be able to get back to accountable government without strengthening the parties.
Francis, we have about 30 seconds left. Anything to add to that?
Strong parties sound like a bad idea. But if you think about the unintended consequences of DIY, do-it-yourself politics, things can be a lot worse. So it's a world of trade-offs, and this is a trade-off we think is a good one to make.
Francis McCall Rosenbluth and Ian Shapiro are professors of political science at Yale University and the authors of Responsible Parties, Saving Democracy from Itself, which is published by Yale University Press, and it came out in October. Ian, thank you for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Francis, thank you for your time today.
Enjoyed it. Thank you.
Still to come on Main Street, a look at food trends in 2019. But now it's time for the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. New Minnesota Transportation Commissioner Margaret Anderson Kelleher is paving the way for a potential gas tax increase. The former House Speaker was named by new Governor Tim Walz to head MnDOT. In 2008, she spearheaded a successful override of then-Governor Tim Pawlenty's veto of a gas tax increase. Kelleher says she doesn't think it has to be a partisan battle or a battle that divides rural roads and urban transit interests.
You know, it's been conservative places that have raised the gas tax. Places like Georgia have raised the gas tax. Totally red. So I think that what your local folks know, the folks who are doing the engineering in cities and the leaders at City Hall know, is that if that gas tax goes up, they are going to see benefit off of it.
But Republican Senate Majority Leader Paul Gazelka says he is not in favor of raising the gas tax.
I'm open to putting more dedicated money towards roads and bridges. I think we ought to take all of the sales tax on auto parts and apply it. I just don't think we need to raise taxes again to do the things that we need to do.
The Red River Basin Commission is taking a serious look at a way to control water releases from field drainage tiles. Executive Director Todd Priester says a grant will determine if it's feasible to install tile on an entire sub-watershed as a start.
We can draw that water out of the soil in the fall before the frost, and then when it comes to spring and there's flooding concerns, maybe we don't open the tile drains and there is a retentional water built in there until the flood threat is passed, and then they can turn on the pumps and be in the field in 4 or 5 days. That is a huge impact. But if we don't look at it in a holistic manner, they're going to install tile sort of willy-nilly.
Preister says poorly managed, the tile drains can aggravate flooding by adding to river crests. The Basin Commission has sent out certified letters this week about public meetings planned to determine interest and discussion about best ways this can happen. There are thousands of miles of tile now installed to drain fields, and Preister expects within 10 years, 90% of the valley will be tiled. And there could be some competition between Fargo and Moorhead for a performing arts center. Fargo has been looking at such a venue since 2014. The topic came up during the Chamber's State of the Cities event. Moorhead Mayor Jonathan Judd made it clear such a venue is on his radar.
Well, I'm going to be the biggest advocate. I think Minnesota has funding where we can make that happen, and we want it to be probably the top-notch facility in our region. And so I think that Performing Arts Center is something that, in my opinion, is in Moorhead's DNA and needs to be in Moorhead.
Fargo Mayor Tim Mahoney told the crowd the city is moving ahead with an updated study on the feasibility of a performance center on the site of what is now the Civic Center.
The Performing Arts Committee is working on the study options for this design, funding, and operation of this facility. And I know, Mayor Judd, you say you want it in Moorhead, but let's figure that out. And this is the goal of our team this year.
An architectural firm hired by the city may have the information to guide decision-making related to the downtown Fargo Performance Center when the task force meets later this month. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Hi, I'm Jack Russell Weinstein, host of Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. When people think of literacy, they think of simple reading and writing. But it's a lot more complicated than that. It involves culture, power, and the opinion of others. On Why Radio, we'll discuss what literacy means, the way it plays into stereotypes, and how different institutions choose their own definitions. So join me and my guest Kim Donahauer for What is Literacy? On the next Why Radio, Sunday at 5 p.m. Central, here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg in studio with Doug Hamilton. And joining us from our Bismarck studio is Root Cellar Sue. It's time for another installment of Main Street Eats. Sue Balcom, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, let's talk about foodies. We're all foodies here on these microphones. What are the trends for the new year?
Isn't that strange that they would put out a trend on what we're going to be eating in 2019?
People decide that, though.
They do. And you know how they decide it? I think that they're monitoring us on Facebook, and they're looking at what people are actually eating, what foods they're purchasing, and then what new foods we're trying. Because as you know, over the past, probably 10 years or so, like, food has become a really popular topic. People are actually vacationing just to try foods in different regions and countries.
I'm eating it every day.
I am too. Well, you know, I think our ag commissioner once said that they did a survey and 4 out of 4 people eat every day. So
which
we're
is good
in the
for
right
the
business.
State. Yeah, that's really good. And they drive cars too.
you have to go to work, you know, and then you have to go out for lunch. So,
well, you gave us a little cheat sheet of what to expect in 2019, and this is a list put out by Whole Foods. And first off, Pacific Rim flavors.
There was a movie that came out a couple years ago about a Pacific Rim, and I'd never heard that term before, but we're talking about things that are coming from Polynesian countries, Hawaii, you know, things that would never grow here in North Dakota, that we have to drive to get here or fly to get here. Things like dried shrimp or shrimp paste, you know, you can make all kinds of things and flavor them with shrimp paste. But there's stuff in the stores right now. If you look around, the ugliest fruit you've ever seen, like passion fruit, dragon fruit, things with spines, things that you just are really, you look at them and you're like, seriously, I'm going to eat that? But people are experimenting a little bit with all of these other flavors. You know, in addition to pineapple, which to me is a traditionally good fruit from those countries.
Yeah, I like to go to the Asian market and just pick out what to me, as, you know, from the Midwest and white, seems exotic, and I just am like, okay, I'm trying this one. I don't know what it is sometimes until I get home.
And the flavors are probably great, but it's how do you bust into this stupid thing
that
sometimes
that
is kind of like why people, I think, shy away from it.
Yeah.
But you will see, like, we do not have a Whole Foods here, but our regular grocery stores on the western side of the state here do actually carry some of these crazy fruits. And I've never seen a jackfruit or
they're
a monk
yummy.
Fruit. Are they really?
They are.
Well, it said it can be used as an alternative to meat. Like,
I know
do you barbecue
few,
it?
I know. I have never done it. I just take it on hikes and just, you know, it's just a nice refreshing fruit to eat like in the sun. But I do have a lot of vegetarian friends and they do that for like vegetarian and vegan barbecues.
Interesting.
Say
a barbecued
a
fruit.
Texture.
Oh, yes. A texture, right.
Yeah.
Well, and you know, it's fun to experiment with all these things,
always.
But you've got to remember, too, that, you know, in January, people think about eating less sugar, and fruit does have sugar in it, but it's not as bad as eating, you know, like Krispy Kreme donut sugar.
It's not the added sugar.
I've always wished that the supermarkets, when they're selling something like dragon fruit or passion fruit or jackfruit, would actually have a sample there because they can be kind of expensive. As you mentioned, they can be intimidating to get into. And if you're not sure about the flavor, it's kind of hard to, you know.
That's a
not
great
all
idea.
Of us are Ashley.
Or even know how to pick one because I've gotten ones before that I thought, well, this is a terrible fruit. But then it turned out I just didn't know how to pick a ripe one.
Oh, yeah, that's actually an excellent point. I have to make that suggestion. Maybe that's another gig I can get into.
Can you make this happen, Sue?
Yeah, let's do some videos. Yes.
I want to see that.
And so if you don't want to deal with fruit, let's say you don't want to deal with this funky fruit, you've got to move on to the new shelf-stable probiotics.
Wow.
Which to me is kind of crazy because, you know, being German and eating sauerkraut, which is number one on the list of probiotic.
Yeah, how much more shelf stable
right.
can you get?
That's what I'm thinking, too. I don't understand exactly what they're doing because probiotic means alive, you know, and in order to keep something alive, you have to usually refrigerate it. So what they're working on now, of course, is playing on everybody's need to step on the probiotic bandwagon without having to learn to love sauerkraut, which travesty in my mind. But they're adding probiotics to granola and soups and nut butters so that people will be able to ingest them without having to actually enjoy sauerkraut or pickles, which, boy.
Do you lose some of the health benefit? You know, like there are some vegetables that taste better when they're cooked, but they're not as healthy as when they're raw?
In my honest opinion, I would say yes, but I have nothing scientific to back that up. So I'm not sure how they can extract those living things and keep them alive in something like a nut butter.
Well, when I was a kid, I'd pull a carrot out of the ground, and that probably was about as probiotic as anything because I ate it, of course.
That's
and,
right.
And probiotic is just a nice way of saying human-friendly bacteria, I think.
That's a great way to put it because somebody said that if you – you know the Peanuts cartoon, there was Pigpen? We really, if you could see all the little things crawling around on us and in us, that's what we would look like.
Thanks for that.
So it's called a healthy microbiome.
There we go. I love that word too, microbiome. But in addition to, and this is the part that just drove me nuts, I'm like, okay, so people aren't going to eat sauerkraut. They might eat peanut butter with probiotics in, but they're actually starting to add probiotics to healthy cleaning supplies, hand lotions,
what?
And things like sunscreen.
It can
I won't
be
looking for that
the
on
skin?
The label.
God, me neither. How does that work? I suppose you would absorb
gut.
It, right? I know.
I don't know.
So I'm thinking, if we're giving these thumbs up and thumbs down, I'd say thumbs up to the funky fruit, thumbs down to the shelf-stable probiotics, right? And just eat sauerkraut.
Well, let's talk about something we really do like, which is fat.
Ooh, yummy, yummy. Do you guys eat butter? Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, hook it to my veins.
Just a little bit.
Just a little bit, yes. You know, when the margarine craze started, you know, in probably the 50s or something, and I got married about 11 years ago and moved out to the country where I'm at right now, and my husband wanted fresh baked bread. And I'm like, okay, I can do that. I can bake bread every week. And then he would put margarine on it. And I'm like, how
many?
He's
alive to tell about it.
Oh, my gosh. I said, this is not acceptable. You cannot put margarine on fresh baked bread. And so he complained about the butter always being hard. So I bought a butter bell. And we keep our butter on the counter. And now all is peaceful in the Belcom family household. So you have to start eating fats. Fats are really, really important. Well,
especially
to
like
your
avocados,
brain.
Right?
Oh, and what did I see? Avocado ice cream, and I thought of you, Ashley.
I would eat that. You know it.
But yes, fat, P-H-A-T. Fats are making a comeback. And that includes things like lard, which I have rendered my own lard. I do make my own soap. So I use, if I happen to burn my lard while I'm rendering it, I use that in my soap. Nobody knows the difference. But you know that people love their chocolate. And so the thing that I have not yet tried, but maybe you have, is a fat bomb. Have you ever done that with coconut butter and chocolate?
Yeah, I totally do that.
So that's something I'd like to try in the new year because coconut butter or coconut oil, that's one of the good fats. And, of course, butter from cows like Kerrygold, that's a good fat. And really you need the fat in milk. Like we drink whole milk at our house. Straight from the cow because not everybody will do that. And I'm not going to get into whether that's right or wrong, but we love that milk. But it always behooves me that they've taken the fat out of milk for kids in school when their brains are developing. It's so important for brains to have fat. That's what they run on. Which might explain why some of us are smarter than other people, I guess, because we still eat butter. But anyway.
Well, my mother cooked with lard.
And lard. Yeah. Oh, my gosh. And pie crust. Butter and lard combo in a pie crust. That is the best thing ever. But have you ever tried butter coffee?
No.
Oh, my gosh. So. It sounds horrible. But what you do is you take about a tablespoon of butter and a tablespoon or so of coconut oil, the solidified stuff. And then you pour 16 ounces of freshly brewed hot coffee over that and blend it in the blender. Now, the person whose blog I was reading said, you don't really want to look at that cup of coffee because you will see oil floating on the top of it. But it's supposed to be really, really good to keep you full. Like drink it in the morning, keep you full until lunch. It helps your metabolism so you actually lose weight from these things.
I have done it with the coconut oil and I've just sort of noticed someone like me, the tendency, especially when it's cold, is to drink cup after cup after cup and you don't get as jittery.
Right. So. That was another thing too is it kind of levels out that high that you get from a cup of caffeine. And so you've kind of like evened out your morning coffee, let's say. And so I thought I would absolutely try that. But they do say you should use unsalted butter. And if you can find it, once again, I would recommend the Kerrygold because that stuff is amazing.
Well, the farm bill that just passed does legalize industrial hemp. So, yeah, you've been able to see some hemp in some smaller market stores for a while now, but likely we're going to be seeing this in bigger batches now.
Well, I think in addition to the industrial hemp, there's kind of a trend. As you know, we had a bill that didn't pass in North Dakota for recreational hemp.
Mm-hmm.
And
marijuana.
Yes.
We're all adults.
Oh, that's right. We should tell people that that's what we're talking about. But I was pretty excited to see in the farm bill that they legalized industrial hemp because it is absolutely an amazing thing. I've used hemp fiber, fabric and yarn. Mm-hmm. It's hard wearing. It continues to get softer all the time. You know, like when you wash it, it will continue to get soft. But it can be used for rope. It can be used for lotions. I love hemp lotion. You can eat the seeds. You can grow it as a microgreen, which is amazing. And now you won't get arrested if they find out that that's what you have in your greenhouse over the winter, which I don't, but now I can because it'll be good for farmers. You know, the tobacco industry has kind of like killed off some farms down south, and they think that this would be a good replacement for them.
Well, a long time ago, it was a very popular commodity crop, and then, of course, we had laws passed, and it looked too much like something else. So.
Right, and there's no THC in industrial hemp. And one of the things, and they've been growing it in Canada for years and years now. Of course, they won't tell you where those fields are. I don't know if they just don't want people hunting around there. But they do have some farms in North Dakota that actually have been allowed to experiment with growing hemp. Part of the problem has been that we no longer have the infrastructure to process it. Because much like linen, it's a hard fiber, and so it has to have special equipment to break or ret down those fibers in order to make it into things like fabric. But it dyes wonderfully. It's so wonderful to wear. And of course, now it will become a bigger trend in food this year. So look for that on your shelf, any kind of hemp-derived products.
Well, Sue, you are always very informative, and we're going to continue this conversation next week as we pick up the conversation of food trends. Thank you, Sue.
Thank you.
Sue joins us once a week to talk about food, and you can always check out the podcast. It is called Main Street Eats. What's happening is next.
Next time on Prairie Pulse, we'll spend the full half hour with representatives from AARP North Dakota as they talk about the crucial issue of caregiving and how it affects family members. That's next time on Prairie Pulse.
Friday at 7:30 on the television service of Prairie Public.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Well, that is a question we ask ourselves once a week here on Prairie Public because, well, we like to know what is going on. In studio with me is Director of Radio, Bill Thomas. Bill, thanks for joining us.
Yes, and this first one, it's particularly appropriate for the Director of Radio to do because it's a radio play, but it's not over the radio. It's like a simulation of a radio play that you go to see in person, and those are really fun.
Meta.
It's on Sunday, January 13th. It's at the Heritage Center and State Museum in Bismarck. And the play is based on a tombstone, which is an unusual way to start writing a play. But the tombstone is in Medora, and it says, "The man the bank fell on." That's what it says on the tombstone, and nobody knows who it is. So somebody made up a story about it and made a play out of it.
This is a real tombstone?
It's a real tombstone.
The story is...
The story's not real.
Who knows?
No. So it's at 2 o'clock. What? It's free at the Heritage Center and State Museum in Bismarck. Radio play, "The Man the Bank Fell On."
The Asa O. Fisher in Dakota presentation is tonight in Bismarck at the former governor's mansion and state historical site. This person was an early Bismarck pioneer who started lots of businesses in the region and was active in local and state politics and then gifted the home that became the governor's mansion. And so you can learn about Asa O. Fisher in Dakota at the former governor's mansion. This speaking engagement is at 7 o'clock tonight, again at the historical site of the former governor's mansion, and it's free.
Okay, here's one on Saturday in Williston. Who in Williston does not want to dress up like a Star Wars person? You know, everybody does, right?
Depends on the weather. I mean, Chewbacca would be a good one to go with, but I don't know, Princess Leia in the bikini, not a good idea.
Yeah, so this is at the James Memorial Arts Center in Williston. If you want to wear a chainmail bikini, check the weather first. You need to come up with a team of three people. You don't have to dress up, but it's better if you do. And it's Star Wars trivia. Test your Jedi knowledge. Space for 20 teams. It costs $30 per team to participate. Starts at 7 p.m. on this Saturday night.
Fight the Frost, Friday through Sunday in Fargo at the Fargo Dome. Your kids are probably driving you extra crazy because it's too cold to go outside and do anything. So bring them to the Fargo Dome where there's going to be a bunch of inflatable games from Games Galore that even includes obstacle courses and a kiddie land, dodgeball, mini golf. You know, these kids have got to get the wiggles out. And it's nice and warm inside the Fargo Dome for a Fight the Frost this weekend. So the hours on Friday are noon to 9. On Saturday, it's 9 to 9. And on Sunday, it's noon to 6. And it costs $15.
Yeah, take them every day. They'll be worn out. One of the things I love to do, if you're around one of the communities that has a campus, there's a bunch of campuses around North Dakota, check for the music events they do there. The student musical events on campuses, the performances I have heard have always been really excellent. And one of them this Friday, January 11th, in Dickinson at Dickinson State University, 7 o'clock. It's free, the Dickinson State University Jazz Ensemble Concert. So have some fun and go to it.
There's a sushi class in Devil's Lake this Saturday, the 12th, at the Masonic Temple. Sushi is delicious, but it's quite difficult to make. You really got to fine-tune those skills, and you can learn how to make this in Devil's Lake at the Masonic Temple. This class gets started at 5 o'clock on Saturday the 12th, and it is $40, and you should contact the Masonic Temple for more information.
Catch fish in Devil's Lake to put in your sushi?
I don't think walleye sushi is a very good idea.
Yeah, no.
Saltwater fish, people.
I went to an all-you-can-eat sushi restaurant once, and they had a big sign up, you got to eat the rice. And that is relevant to the next thing, which in Fargo, at the Fargo Theater, this Saturday at 2 o'clock, so it's an afternoon thing, it's free, there's a movie called Wasted, the story of food waste. And I think people are familiar with the idea that, like, hey, we waste too much food. Anthony Bourdain, Dan Barber, Mario Batali, Massimo Bottura, panel discussion following the film live with local food people. So that could be pretty interesting, and I'm sure they won't let you throw any popcorn on the floor.
All right, my pick is the Lego Robotics Regional Tournament. That's coming up this Saturday the 12th at Minot State University. And so learn about robotics or come watch these kids and the amazing robots that they I shouldn't say kids about all of this, but I know this is at Minot State. But 8 to 1 o'clock on Saturday in Minot, and it's free.
All right. Now, if I could, I would, maybe I will, go all the way out to Watford City, because that's a ways from where I am right now, to the Rough Riders Center. This Saturday, 12:30 to 4, cost $1 a ticket to get in, and it is the Rough Riders Center 2019 Cook-off. All soup lovers are invited. This is a great time of year for soup, and you won't want to miss it. And call Elise at the Rough Riders Center if you want to sign up as a soup cooker contestant. 842-3665, extension 1132.
That's what's happening. Prairie Public is a proud media partner for the 22nd Annual Celebration of Women and Their Music, Saturday, January 19th at the stage at Island Park. Featuring Natalie Fiddler, Diane Miller, Nina Grohlman, Lucy Michelle, Sarah Moreau, Gina Powers, Jessica Vines, and many more.
Why don't you come and sit down that chair?
Tickets available at 22celebrationofwomen.eventbrite.com. You can find complete information on all 3 days of events at debjenkins.com/celebrationofwomen.
Strength in our number.
This is Dakota Datebook for January 10th. In January of 1890, North Dakota was just a few months old. In voting to approve the Constitution, the people also voted in favor of Prohibition. Consequently, saloons would only be legal until July. In her book, Grass of the Earth, Immigrant Life in the Dakota Country, teacher and author Auguste Ron tells about the women of Hatton who weren't willing to wait. Auguste's father, Thomas, had developed a habit of hauling the grain crop to town and spending the proceeds in the saloon before returning home empty-handed. Then he would sell some livestock, intending to purchase supplies, and again come home with nothing. Others in Hatton had similar problems, and there was growing resentment of the town's six saloons. On this date in 1890, Augut's mother, Runhild, was among a dozen or so women who headed into town armed with hatchets, hammers, and long sticks. It was a busy day, with people everywhere. Augut Ron writes that the first saloon was so busy, the owner hardly looked up when the door opened. The women rushed in and madly chopped, smashed, and raked down liquor bottles so that the whole floor was soaking wet in a minute. Augut's mother took chairs and benches, lifted them, and hurled them at the shelves, windows, and mirrors. The crowds in the streets cheered. The women even went to the cellar and chopped at the kegs and barrels until streams of liquor flowed and their shoes and long skirts were wet. The women moved from saloon to saloon. When they got to the last one, the owner stood outside and said in Norwegian, "Please, go in." The women complied, but were met by a cloud of burning pepper, so strong that they coughed and gasped for breath. The trick deterred the raiders and saved the saloon. As on most battlegrounds, there was collateral damage. During one of the raids, patron Peter Lohman suffered a cut on the head. That evening, he resumed his drinking and apparently failed to tend to the wound. 3 weeks later, he was dead of an infection. The saloon keeper said the women caused his death. The sheriff summoned the women to trial, and Augut writes that her mother had a good time listening to all the funny things the witnesses said and the speeches of the lawyers and the judge. Her mother said, "We had good food and slept in good beds. I had a real vacation." We have to assume that the women of Hatton were cleared on the merits of the case, and not because the judge was afraid to convict. Today's Dakota Daybook was written by Mary Helm. I'm Meryl Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
In pushing for a border wall, President Trump says he is speaking on behalf of Homeland Security officials.
These are the resources they have requested to properly perform their mission and keep America safe. In fact, safer than ever before.
So what do Border Patrol agents say themselves? John Burnett reports on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Thursday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, UND philosophy professor Jack Russell Weinstein joins us to preview his upcoming episode of Why? Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life, as he discusses literacy with UND English professor Kim Donahauer. News director Dave Thompson joins us to talk about this week's biggest news, and Matt O'Lean reviews The Favorite. That's all coming up tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.